Hi everyone, it's Gavin J, the best thing since Tigers. And you're listening to Therapy Suite right here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. This week, I talked to Sally Hogg from the Parent Infant Foundations. Welcome to the show, Sally. How are you doing?
Good to be here with you.
I'm good, thank you. Sally, I think the best place to start with is tell us a bit about yourself and your background and how you got to where you are today.
Oh, that's a big question. So I'm a psychology graduate. I went into the civil service and worked in children's policy. And I guess at the heart of that was this belief that what happens to children will influence their life chances, and that's where we can most make a difference. Having been in the civil service, I went to the NSPCC and I led a load of work there that specialised in the earliest years of life, so pregnancy in the early and the first years of life, and how we could support families in that phase to be the parents that they wanted to be for their babies. And since then, for the last decade or more, I've been working in this area of supporting the most vulnerable families from conception until their child is two. And I'm now Deputy CEO at the Parent Infant Foundation.
Brilliant. So there's aims and objectives that are set at the beginning, basically, when you start working with families. Is that right? In terms of you hearing what they want to do and what they want to aim to achieve, and then you help them work to that point. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I don't work directly with families. So my role, I'm Deputy of the charity and I work in policy and campaigning. So how do we campaign for families to get the support that they need, particularly around what we call specialised parent infant provision, which is therapeutic support for families where there are struggles in that early relationship, and we can work with families to ensure that they can provide their, that parents can provide their babies with the sensitive nurturing care, which we know is really essential for early development. In terms of a family's experience of those services, yeah, it would start with often with a referral, maybe some health visiting or maternity or another service working with the family, and they would meet somebody from the parent infant team who would try and understand their needs, what's going on, what their baby's experience is, and then work through the best sort of package of care for them. That might be one-to-one therapy, it might be group work. Sometimes our therapists would do different sorts of interventions. So for example, sometimes we use something called video interaction guidance, which involves filming a bit of a parent and their child interacting, and then the therapist will pull out moments where that seems to be going really well, and usually is on the basis to coach the parent to really pull the door on those strengths. So there's a range of support, yeah, based on the family's needs and what's going on for the parents and the baby, and what can best strengthen that early relationship.
All right, okay. Let's start right from the beginning. I think it's my fault. We've kind of jumped ahead, isn't it? Which I tend to do. Let's start right from the beginning. Tell us a bit more about, you've mentioned a few things, obviously, and is there anything else that the Parent Infant Foundation does in terms of how it works with, you know, people, parents and the child? What do you do on the ground floor? What happens?
Well, so we don't directly see any families. We are a charity that exists to support these parent infant teams that we just met before. So specialised parent infant relationship teams exist in the voluntary sector, in the NHS, in local authorities around the country. There are currently 42 of them in the UK and more developing. So we work with anybody who wants to set up a team. That might be a clinician or a commissioner who thinks, yeah, this is a gap in our services for families and we want to get those early relationships right. So we would provide them with lots of resources and expertise to help them develop a service. And then with those teams that exist around the country, we bring them together to share learning, we support their development and evaluation of what they do. And then we're also a policy and campaigning charity. So we campaign for more of that sort of provision to exist for babies so that we don't, as a society, wait until problems emerge later in life and then try and sort them, but actually support families with good support right at the beginning of life. And we coordinate a campaigning movement called the First 1,000 Days Movement, which is an alliance of 200 heritage and professional bodies that work together to campaign for the best support for babies and their families.
What are some of the struggles that you're aware of that the Parent Foundation help with when it comes to the child and working with the child and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so the specific issue that the work is focused on is that it's the early relationship between parents and babies. So what babies need in order to thrive is an adult in their life who can provide sensitive nurturing care that really responds to their needs and what that baby needs for them. And there are a number of reasons why some parents struggle to provide that. Often it's around what we call intergenerational trauma. So parents who just themselves not received nurturing care and love from adults in their lives, and so they find it very difficult to then provide that for their babies. But often there'll be other things, other adversity in the family's life that make it harder for parents to be the parent that they want to be. That might be mental health problems, substance abuse, domestic violence. Often it's accumulation of a number of different risk factors that are affecting the parent's ability to parent. But that kind of intergenerational trauma and the lack of kind of a model of what nurturing parent looks like can be a real barrier. So the specific reason why families would come to us would be about the need for help with that relationship, but there might be a number of underlying risk factors that drive that.
What are some of the things that, if, for example, the parent's got some sort of mischief issues or mental health problems, what's done to try and help them with that kind of area, do you know?
Well, so it would be important that they got support for those issues in their own right. That might, if it's a mum with mental health issues, for example, she might get support from a perinatal mental health centre in the NHS, or she might get support from a voluntary sector, maybe a peer support organisation, depending on the nature of her mental health problems. And obviously there are a variety of different substance abuse services in different areas. But what we know from a baby's perspective is that when families struggle with those other problems in their life, it can affect the way that they're able to parent their baby. And just solving the issues that are affecting the adults doesn't necessarily also resolve some of the things that are going on in that parenting relationship. So what our students would do would be as part of a kind of suite of services that might be supporting different elements of the challenges facing a family. They will focus specifically on parenting and the relationship with the baby. And it's also important that support picks in as soon as possible. So we know that babies are developing really, really quickly and that their development is shaped by their early experiences. So it's really important that babies get good sensitive nurturing care as early as possible in their life. So we can't wait for parents to resolve all of the challenges in their life and then say, okay, well, now we'll think about you as a parent. These services have to be working alongside each other so that we're thinking about the baby's experience alongside the parent's problems.
Is in terms of the package of care, talk to us a bit about that. What can be put in place by the parenting teams? Is that right? Parenting teams work with the parent and the infant.
So parent infant teams is our kind of shorthand for specialised parent infant relationship teams. We've got a bit of a mouthful. So parent infant teams is that. And anybody working with these teams on the ground, they've often got different names that will be kind of, so people might know them as an attachment service or a one of the services called Little Minds Master. They can call different things. But anyway, they are multidisciplinary teams, which means they've got different professionals working on them. So you always have a mental health professional, which will either be a psychologist or a psychotherapist with a particular specialism in working with babies and their parents. And then working with that mental health professional will be a range of other professionals that might include things like health assistant, midwife, social worker, peer supporter, family support worker, so a range of different things. And what that multidisciplinary team can then do is work with different elements of what's going on for the family. So you might get a family support worker, for example, who helps perhaps to connect the family to the other sources of support and resolve some of the more practical issues they're facing. You might have a psychologist or psychotherapist offering kind of quite in-depth one-to-one work with the parent, perhaps to resolve some of the kind of psychotherapy issues and to really work on that relationship. And the parents may also attend perhaps a group work programme or a peer support programme to help them connect to other families and to give them some sort of more practical parenting support and tips. So you might get a range of different things simultaneously, or it may be that the team says actually what this family really needs is this specific intervention from you. They need some help having the confidence to be the parent they want to be. So your 6 sessions of video interaction guidance might be the right thing for the family. So the beauty of that multidisciplinary team and having a range of different things they can offer is you can really think about what does this family need and how do we best meet their needs rather than having a kind of one size fits all approach.
That's fantastic. I think having the MDT involved, the shorthand for multidisciplinary team, do you think it helps the parent feel more confident that they've got more people around them to kind of support?
Every parent's experience of this will be different, right? And some parents will just want that one relationship with one person, and a team can provide that. for others, yeah, those kind of being able to tap into different sorts of support will be helpful. And for some parents, it'll be a bit of a journey. So they may not have a lot of different sorts of support at the same time. They might have, for example, they might start with the more intensive psychotherapy. And then when they are feeling more ready to engage, that might be a great point to move them to a kind of group work program to help them to sort of mix with other parents and think about some other things. And then they might then move on from the service with a range of different skills and confidence as a result of the different interventions they've had.
Absolutely. You don't often hear about babies being impacted by trauma. Why do you think that is?
I think the idea of kind of babies' mental health and babies' experience, like, you know, psychological trauma for babies are quite hard for us to imagine because we don't really think very much about the emotional world of very little children. As a society, we don't often kind of tune into what are our babies thinking and them being little people with this mental health. We also, I think, have some quite unhelpful ideas of what mental health is as a society, thinking it specifically about kind of diagnosable mental illness. It's obviously, you know, babies don't have in the same way, so people can struggle to think, well, what would this mean for a baby? And what is kind of trauma for a baby? So we talk about psychological trauma, which is when babies are exposed to things happening in the world around them that lead them to be highly stressed for long periods of time. And we know that it's called toxic stress. So when babies are experiencing kind of an unrelenting amount of stress, then that can be really damaging for their developing body and brain. And the sort of trauma that babies experience is partly about what's going on in the world around them, but largely about actually their parent or their caregiver and what's happening in that relationship. Because if you imagine a very small baby, actually, if you're being held by somebody who makes you feel safe, kind of doesn't matter what's happening in the world around you. It won't make you feel traumatized because you're not really aware of it. You're just aware of feeling safe in the arms of someone you love. So good relationships can protect babies from a loss of trauma. Whereas, if there are problems in that early relationship, if the person you most rely on to feed you, to care for you, to love you, is actually scary, maybe they're abusive, or maybe they're neglectful, maybe they've got so much going on in their life, they're not able to meet your needs, then that can really feel traumatic for babies because babies are totally dependent on adults for everything in their lives. So if they can't rely on an adult, then that will feel very stressful and traumatic. So the things that cause babies trauma and stress might be different from kind of older children or adults who have a different experience of the world and aren't quite dependent on those early relationships. But what we do know is that what happens to babies in the early months of life shapes how their bodies and brain develop. So if babies are exposed to this toxic stress, then it can influence how they go on to respond to stress and other issues later in their life. And it can increase the risk of mental health problems. It can increase the risk of physiological problems like heart disease. So really important that we try and protect babies from that toxic stress.
No, absolutely. Very interesting because even, I'll be honest with you, I've never really heard of, like, you know, a baby experiencing trauma. You know, when you see a baby, it's like, oh, you know, they're cute, you feed them. And body language wise, maybe it's me. Maybe I've never seen a baby that's experiencing trauma, so I can't tell the signs or anything like that. I mean, are there signs or anything at all? Or
they are, but they can be very subtle. I think what So some parents would often train other professionals, social workers and health sisters in infant mental health, early trauma, what those signs might look like. And I think what professionals would often say is, yes, I could feel something that was wrong with that baby, but what this training does is enable me to really identify it, tune into it and articulate it. So I think if you saw a baby who was traumatized, you might intuitively think, this doesn't feel right, this baby doesn't feel happy or comfortable, but you wouldn't necessarily know what's going on. And with training in this area, that helps you to understand it. So some of the signs might be some babies are what we call hypervigilant. They might kind of freeze or be kind of high alert. You might feel that in their bodies and how they respond to stuff. One of the early signs, and again, you can just sort of see what babies see this, is that, I don't know if you know, but when babies are born, they are born wanting to connect with adults, kind of evolutionary thing that babies will look at faces more than they'll look at anything else, and they will move towards voices. They're kind of, their whole body is attuned to sort of find an adult. So a very small baby will always look, particularly if parents will always be trying to make eye contact. Not all the time, they might in a way look at the rest of the world, but you know, if there's a face there, they will try and make some contact with it. Whereas a baby who's had very difficult interactions with an adult, and maybe some had some sort of scary feedback from their parent or caregiver, will actually have learned that it's not a good thing to look at faces, that actually they might be scary or they might not give the baby everything they want. So then you start to see these babies who will look away and look away from babies and really actively try and alert their gaze, even from their parents. And so a health system might say, because look, this little baby, whenever the mum comes here, rather than what most babies do, which is gazing towards their mum, is turning away and actively trying to kind of move their head away. And that's the sign that something's gone wrong. So you see these kind of, you know, babies are tiny and they can't do that much, but you can, if you pull into their keys, you can start to see these little signs that something's not right in that baby. The other thing, which is really, really sad, is you get some babies who've been neglected who stop crying because they've basically learned that crying is sort of a waste of energy, that, you know, nobody comes when you cry.
Oh, that's sad, yeah.
It's really sad. And as a society, we almost have this notion that babies don't cry, good babies. It's just like, oh, that's a, that, you know, might say, oh, well, isn't that baby good? It's calm. But actually, if we really watch what's going on for that baby, they're not calm. They might actually be quite stressed. You might see signs of tension in them, but they're not crying because they don't, they've learned that actually that external kind of making that noise to want to get adult attention is just not worth it for them. They're not going to get it. Or even it might attract a sort of unhelpful adult attention if they've had experiences of somebody maybe being very upset with them when they cry. So there are definitely signs there, but we need to feed into them.
Oh, thank
they're
you
different from what they might look in older
children. Yeah, yeah. And you're saying they're very subtle signs they can be as well, isn't it? No worries. We're just going to a quick ad break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
So, Sally, thank you for joining us for the show today. I know in June saw the annual Infant Mental Health Awareness Month, and you had a new report out. What were you saying in this, and why is it such an important event?
So we run Infant Mental Health Awareness Week every June, and sort of goes to what we were talking about before the break around, you know, we know all babies have mental health, and we know that that mental health is shaped by the world around them, and also provides the foundation for their later development. That's something a lot of people don't necessarily know about or think about, might even find a little bit uncomfortable to think about, because if your concept of mental health isn't one about well-being, but it's more about mental illness, then it might be hard for you to think about, well, what the baby's mental health. So we want to help to raise awareness of infant mental health, baby's mental health, and for people to start thinking about what's going on for our babies and how do we give them the best foundations for emotional and social well-being and development the rest of their lives. So that's basically what Infant Mental Health Month is about every year, and it's a global event. We do all sorts of activities, from social media campaigns to workforce savings to lovely little drop-ins from for parents and babies and in places around the country. And every year we choose a topic. And this year we talked about understanding early trauma, because we really wanted to shine a spotlight on the babies who are having a very difficult time and exposed to psychological trauma and what that means for them. And we wanted to look at how that plays out throughout the baby's life. So we did, for example, a survey of early education professionals, so people working in childcare, assessing preschools, reception of primary schools, to say what sort of problems and behaviours and difficult challenges are some of the New York classes experiencing as a result of things that have happened to them in the first year of life. and how if we understand that sometimes those behaviours are a result of early trauma, of early relationship difficulties, how does that help us to prevent those problems, but also to deal with them perhaps in a more compassionate and more effective way when they do arise? And so we had, for example, in that report, stories of young children who were starting school, unable to settle down, unable to make friendships or distrust adults because they've learned through their early experiences maybe that relationships with adults are difficult, and they'll have, because they've been exposed to a lot of stress early in life, they've got a heightened fight or flight response, so they react pretty quickly to stuff, which makes it quite difficult to have, you know, normal social interactions and deal with the ups and downs of everyday life. And so what we wanted to really do is to build the case for action very early, to get things right for babies early, so that we can reduce some of those problems and we can have more of our kids starting school able really to thrive.
You mentioned global a bit earlier. Is that right? It's a global event. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, we started it in the UK, but because of social media and things, it's taken off in other countries too, particularly Australia. There's quite a lot of mental health difficulties that happens in Australia, but we've seen stuff in other countries as well. And in the pandemic years, when we were doing a lot of our events online, actually, we'd get people dialing in from all over the world to watch and listen.
Do you kind of globally liaise with each other around policies and procedures, how things are going to work in the future, how you know, the organization moves forward strategy wise as well?
Yeah, not loads and loads, but we definitely, particularly when we're helping parents and teams to think about what good practice look like, we'll tap into research from all over the world, and we'll be looking at tools and techniques and maybe assessment measures or particular interventions that have got an evidence based from other parts of the world that might come into this country. So that kind of, that learning and knowledge exchange is really important. And again, pre-pandemic, we just had this final get-together of people working in implementing mental health around the world, now online, but that sharing is really important. And there are other countries that are particularly good at thinking about their youngest children and offering support for families.
You know, during COVID, did you find... I'm kind of just thrown out here because it's made me curious now. During COVID, did you find that there were more cases, or not yourself, obviously, because I know it's more the parenting teams, but generally across the UK, or just generally speaking, were there more cases of trauma in babies in terms of needing to support parents as well because of the whole issue that was going on and all the rest of it?
Yeah, so we've done quite a lot of research during the pandemic about the impact it's having on parents and babies. And there was more. Well, I think the first thing to say was that it was very unequal. So some families had a great time in lockdown in terms of being able to really be there for their babies. You know, dads were home for more bedtime. If mum was on maternity leave, but they're actually co-parenting more. The getting rid of the stresses of the rest of life helped actually help make parenting easier. Other families had a very, very different experience, and actually it was incredibly stressful and isolating, and that made it harder for parents and in some cases what might have had a knock-on effect on babies. We saw an increase in social isolation, an increase in poverty, an increase in domestic violence. All of those things we know are risk factors that can make it harder for parents to be the parent they want to be for their baby. And we did see increases in abuse and neglect of babies during that period. And those are cases we know about. There were probably other babies who were experiencing of hostile or neglectful care that didn't reach the threshold for services. We know a lot of babies have just been invisible in the last few years, but health services and other services support families in that time have been really pulled back or stopped in some cases, and so that means that some babies will go into the radar.
Oh gosh, that's very sad. From the website, I see that you're part of the first 1001 Days movement. Tell me more about that group and the importance of emotional well-being of babies.
Yeah, so we set up the first 1001 Days movement. I'll tell you a bit of the history about it. So I guess I didn't start. I've been working in this field of kind of babies and importance of pregnancy in the early years for a number of years. And I have lots of other organisations and brilliant professionals. And one of the things that I observed was that there was a lot of tension in the field. But sometimes it's sort of a bit of an echo chamber, that people who really cared about it were talking to each other and not necessarily using that shared passion to project that outwards and really get some policy change. So in 2019, I started this piece of work to explore with a lot of other organisations and professional bodies, was the value in creating a campaigning alliance and a sort of formal partnership. And so that's where the first 1,000 days movement came about. So it's a campaigning alliance, got just over 200 organisations, which range from massive charities, you know, the NSPUC, Action for Children, through to really tiny local groups that might be helping parents and babies, different parts of the UK, and professional bodies like the Institute for Health and Safety. And we work together to try and campaign with one voice to change government policy so that there's better support available for babies and their families during that period from concept to two, and with a particular focus on social and emotional development. So we're not the people that are thinking about the physical aspects of birth or the emotional care or any of those things, but thinking about actually what do babies need in order to be mentally healthy and to get that early kind of brain development that's going to set them in good stead. And we do national campaigning, trying to campaign to get government to change policy. We've had some really good examples of getting that change in the last year. We also create a lot of resources and noise and arguments and materials that our members can use themselves to get change where they live. So an example of that is we've got kind of infographics and evidence briefs that services can use if they're trying to convince the local decision maker to fund a particular service or to do something for babies in their local area. So what we try and do is to collectively drive change nationally, but also empower and motivate our members to drive change in the spaces that they're in.
In terms of funding, I mean, the strategies that are put in place, are they quite effective in moving things forward?
We do know a lot about what works, and there are some great examples of that. It's really, really variable across the country. So there have been massive cuts in the government funding available for these sorts of services over the last decade. 0.6 billion off the public health grant, which funds
a huge amount of money. Much?
Yeah, 0.6 billion. Huge. And that's all of the money available for public health. And that's the pot at which health and money comes out of. That's a change since 2015 now. Sure Start Children's Centres, budgets and fusion cuts, and a number of other services that would work with families in this period. There have been a little bits of money going in. It was really nice to see some money in last year's spending review, but it was tiny compared to the scale of the cuts. And so in that context, it's really difficult for local areas to provide the services that families need, but some of them still do it. And that's what's really interesting, I think, that whilst national government has made it more difficult, there are still local leaders, whether it's health commissioners or local councillors, who still want to do the best for their babies and manage to find the money somewhere to do that. And there are some great examples of local strategies and local services that are really making a difference. And we try and spotlight them and champion them and share that good practice to try and get more happening everywhere.
Why do you think it can be so challenging sometimes to raise the funds for such worthwhile organisations?
I mean, it's just what we've got before about people don't really understand babies' mental health or what it is and why it matters, and they don't necessarily see it as a problem. So whereas when teenagers have mental health problems, it's much more, you know, if you've got teenagers causing problems in their communities, you know, acting out or having problems themselves, self-harm, eating disorders, those very obvious problems that have knock-on effects for community schools and health services and have a real urgency about them. So if you're a mental health commissioner and you've got a limited pot of money, you're going to be much more drive to fund those sort of services for teenagers, whereas traumatised babies are easy to go under the radar. You know, they're not as obvious. If you've not got skilled professionals who've seen this, sometimes you don't see that need, and it's not creating the same pressure on the system. Now, what we do know is that actually if those babies are left, they are likely to have a number of problems, and they're likely to become children and young people with mental health problems. So it's not like the system will pay the price and have to deal with those children's needs later on, but there's not that same urgency now to do something about it. So it's hard if you're really tight budget, you can work out what to do. How to justify doing the work that's actually kind of that long-term, slow-burn preventative work when you've got lots of people demanding deep care right away.
No, absolutely. No, I absolutely see that. Is there any drive in the future to kind of work on that area, to kind of maybe strategy to try and, don't get me wrong, all organisations are always trying, obviously, to, you know, put something in place, to present to the government in terms of why more funding is needed. I'm guessing that's something yourselves are working on as well. Would I be right?
Yeah, I mean, my job involves our policy campaigning work, but making that case to government for both for investment, but also for other kind of policy bits that can ensure the right services are there. Like I said, we do see some local areas do some amazing things despite the lack of national government initiatives. So Greater Manchester, for example, all of the 10 boroughs of Greater Manchester have a specialised parent relationship team. They have prioritise that provision, and so we will support and advocate for all local decision makers making those sort of decisions, but we will also put pressure on national government to make the changes that make that an expectation of everybody. And so one of the things we talk about a lot is what we call a baby blind spot in mental health provision. There is lots of money going into the system, maybe not enough, but there is money going into the system for mental health services for children, and central government is guiding local decision makers on what to do with that money. And we think actually they need to be sending all the same messages that part of a children's and young people's mental health service should be service that was for the really youngest children. The government needs to send in that direction. We have seen some investments. There was $300 million announced last year over 3 years for local authorities to spend on this period, 1,000 days in Consultant 2. That's on a range of different things. It's the parenting programs, parent infant relationships, for mum and dad's mental health support, breastfeeding and other things. It's not all for the stuff that we've been talking about today, but quite a lot of it is. So that's brilliant. It is a huge amount of money, obviously $300 million, but it's not necessarily a huge amount compared to the amount that's been cut from these services. So it will need to be spent kind of thoughtfully and wisely. But it's only going to half of local authority areas in the country. So that is sort of baking in a bit of a postcode lottery for babies where some areas will have more services than others won't.
No, of course, of course. We're just going to a quick ad break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
So Sally, I mean, thanks for that information around, you know, the 1001 days movement. In terms of the infant's Parent Infant Foundation, it operates across the UK, would I be correct?
Yeah, so we've got a presence in all of the four nations of the UK to some extent.
And is there the same amount of resources in each of those areas, like, you know, England, Wales, Scotland, etc.?
No, so with different nations of the UK, well, they fund children's services and public services different anyway, and so there's a kind of different background from which the services are growing, but we do see greater commitment to this infant mental health parent-infant relationship work in some nations than others. So, for example, in Scotland, there is a commitment for infant mental health services across the whole of Scotland, and there's been money put into the system to support that, and we're very privileged to have funding as a parent infant foundation to work with all of those developing services in Scotland, support them and ensure that they're as effective as they can be and that they learn from all of the other teams in the UK that exist, to help them really hit the ground running. So Scotland is I suppose that this is a prominent national priority, not so much in other nations of the UK. We had a great win of our campaigning work last year, where we worked with a number of partner organisations in Northern Ireland, and the Kenya Mental Health Trust in Northern Ireland now states that children's mental health services should have an offer for children aged under 3, so that basically they should be doing this with children's mental health work. We're yet to see what that's going to really mean in practice, but it's a brilliant breakthrough to see it there in the mental health strategy, this acknowledgement of the youngest children and their needs. In England, we don't yet have kind of national policy that from government that really sets out what should exist and what services need to exist for 0-2s around mental health and early relationships. But the Royal College of Psychiatrists guidance states that there should be parents and teams. We've seen some local authorities decide that all health services decide to provide that provision, even though national government is important. So a Manchester example that I mentioned is part of that, where the region have decided that this is important and it's something they can do, even though they haven't been told to by national government.
So it does kind of vary across the UK in terms of resourcing what there is and what there isn't. And I'm guessing you're working towards bringing that more in line with each of the, areas, basically. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we want national policy change so that it isn't a postcode lottery, and actually there is this clear expectation that all babies get the support. They're very, very clear that this support is incredibly valuable, and it isn't right that at the moment most babies in the UK live in an area where they can't access this service, that it should be existing for everybody. And so we try and work with that place by our national campaign work to try and get a change in national government policy so that it's just an expectation that wherever you are in the country, and health commissioners are held to account for providing this in the same way that, there are other services that just expected to exist in local areas, and that where a local commissioner might be held to account by government if they don't ensure the right services are there. So our policy and campaigning work is trying to get that change, but also we're working with lots of local areas individually in the country to try and persuade them to develop this sort of provision and show them what other their neighbouring areas are doing and help them to learn from that.
Is there feedback from the parents in terms of how the foundation has helped them at all?
Yeah, so, I mean, we don't work with parents directly. So the feedback we have is from...
The parenting teams, would that be right?
Yeah, parenting teams, yeah, exactly. So the parent-infant teams do collect a lot of feedback and measurement about the impact that they have on families. And we've got some lovely quotes by other teams from families who talk about just how valuable this work is to them. And the evidence of the work of parents and teams shows that they do have a positive impact on those early relationships between parents and their babies, but they often also have a positive impact on parents' mental health, because it's sometimes something that feels better to have a great relationship with your baby than to be finding parenting difficult. But it's kind of a bit of a no-brainer. So that work, whilst it's focused on the parenting, has all these kind of knock-on effects, one of which is a visible improvement in parents' own mental health.
Do you use some of that feedback as well to kind of use towards when presented to the government, saying, look, this is the kind of feedback we're getting, is we can prove it's really helping and that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly that. So we collect feedback from the parents and teams on the ground and collate that and present it to government, and we support teams in their evaluation work to try and create the best possible evidence. So we're currently doing a project with the 10 teams that exist in Greater Manchester to really get hold. They've got tons of data for work they're doing, and we're working with them to use that data to create some really good evidence and stories about the impact that they have.
If someone is worried about a baby, infant or child, but isn't sure what the next steps are, what would you say to them so they can get help?
So if you're a parent or caregiver and you're thinking that something isn't quite right for your baby, or maybe your feelings about your baby, that can be really hard to talk about. So my first piece of advice would be, you're not the first person to feel like that, and there is no shame in it. It's absolutely okay not to feel okay. Lots of parents, struggle to be the parent they want to be, don't necessarily feel the way they thought they would or should about their baby. So, but it's really important to talk to people about that. And sometimes an easiest first step is just to talk to a family or friend and get some kind of reassurance, but we would really suggest talking to a professional as well. The obvious professional to talk about as a first port of call is a health visitor, because every family should have a health visitor and they know about this work and they can provide that support. So I'd recommend having a check with a health visitor, and the health visitor maybe can provide some reassurance, or maybe can say, actually, yeah, just know you're struggling, we will refer you for some additional help at the parent infant team. I do know that some people don't know who their health visitor is, aren't seeing health visitors because those services have been so cut. So you may need to find other people that you can have that kind of comfortable conversation with, maybe a GP, maybe a children's centre worker, and really think about who is the person you feel is you're most comfortable talking about this, who might be able to then help you navigate where you can get extra support. And quite a lot of parents and teams would take direct referrals to a family, what we call self-referrals. So if a family just wants to contact the team directly and say, look, I'm struggling, can you help? They would often get a response directly from the team. And our website, parentsandfoundation.org.uk, has a list and a map of all the parents and teams that exist around the UK. So you can have a look at if there's something in your area and whether to kind of contact them directly.
So brilliant, because they go on the website and basically directly get in contact with the parenting teams, or it goes to a central referral point, or?
No, so our website has a map and contact details for every parent infant team that we know of in the UK. And so you have contact details there. So there's links to team's website, and if we've got it, the email or phone call that you would use to make a referral, or to self-referral, just to ask that team for help. I guess one thing that's important to say is that teams don't just provide kind of direct therapeutic support that I talked about earlier. They have a role in providing advice and consultation and training and support. So if you're a professional working with a family and you think, this doesn't look or feel right, I'm worried about this baby, you can call up your local parent infant team and talk through what you're seeing and get some expert advice and help to reflect on what is going on with that baby, are the reasons to be concerned, and what are the best next steps to do that, and what might you be able to do with the family to support that baby and that relationship, or do they need extra help, and how can you find the right help for them?
Is there anything else the parenting team does, which, because maybe I should have asked that question a bit before, but I know we've spoken a lot about them. Is there anything else? I know they do a lot. It sounds like they're so busy, and it must be quite, in some times it must be stressful at some points, I'm guessing. And, you know, there's a lot of emotions. Is there anything else that we haven't mentioned that they do?
Well, they're all so different, and they all operate in different ways. But the core of their approach is two things that I've sort of mentioned already. So one is the direct support to families who are really struggling. And that, as I said before, could be kind of a range of different support that meets the family's needs around their early relationship. So that's one of the strands of work, is the direct therapeutic support. And then the second strand of work is about supporting their local system. So that might be through providing consultation, supervision, advice, training, other support to local professionals like GPs, health visitors, midwives, social workers, to help them to really think about the needs, the emotional needs, the mental health of the babies that they work with, and what support those families might need. And so some of our teams, for example, do a thing called thinking together with health visitors, where if a health visitor is concerned about a family where there's difficulties, they can bring that case to an infant team and talk through what's going on, particularly from that baby's point of view, what's going on for that baby, do they need to be concerned, and what's the right support put in place, and have that kind of reflective conversation that helps them kind of do the right thing for babies.
Can people approach the teams anonymously just to get that initial bit of advice? Because, you know, some people might feel a bit uncomfortable. It's a very sensitive. It's just to call out and say, look, you know what? I feel I need a bit of help in certain areas while looking after my child, or whichever way the person wants to explain it. I'm just wondering about the anonymous side of things. Can they approach the teams and have a discussion before they go full force in with, you know, going forwards with support?
I think in some ways it would depend on the team and how they operate. I think if you have a team where you phone them up and said, I don't want to tell you who I am, but I'm in your local area and I'm really struggling, you know, you've got a compassionate skilled team there, they wouldn't say, sorry, we can't deal with that. But the extent to which they would be able to support you, I think, would be variable depending on how the team works. Some might be willing to have some level of early conversation and provide you with a bit of reassurance and maybe establish a bit of trust. But they might not be able to do a lot of advice but without really feeling comfortable they know what's going on, because they want to make sure they get the advice right, and that involves understanding kind of who a family is and what's going on for them. So I think it would probably be variable depending on the kind of context and the situation, and also just whether it is a team that accepts kind of phone calls from maybe the public, or whether some teams actually have no way of contacting them other than through a slightly more formal route, so you wouldn't be able to just make that anonymous call.
No, of course. I'm just thinking in terms of someone might want to just find out firstly about the service before they start giving their details. Do you know what I mean? Just to get a bit of, I suppose, just to get that bit of rapport, feel a bit more comfortable. Because I think for some people, it takes a lot of confidence to pick up the phone and start talking about, you know, very personal things in relation and relations with, you know, how you look after your child. You feel you're struggling a bit and that kind of thing. You feel the parent might suspect that the child is suffering from trauma themselves. And do you know what I mean? They want to know more about what to do. And so I was just thinking about, and I wanted to make it clear to the listeners as well that there's that kind of opening where, you know, people can talk to people without having to give their details. And when they feel more comfortable, then they can, you know, then that can go, they can go forwards down that pathway.
Yeah, I think most teams would offer some way of doing that. And they might, even though you don't have an email form, and you provide your phone number and then they phone you back to talk through what's going on for you. And you don't really need to share a lot to have that initial conversation. And then once you've got a bit of stress, you think, yes, this is going to be helpful, then you share a bit more. I think, different teams would deal with that in different ways. They generally want to have some details about who they're talking to, just to make sure that they're providing the most appropriate support, and also so that they can maybe draw in other services if they're, you know, there's lots of difficult stuff happening for a family. That's always much easier if you know, obviously, who the family is. And
of course. And you mentioned they can speak to their health visitor anyway, can't they? And get more information that way.
And I would really encourage talking to that. I wouldn't let the fact that you have to share some details about, you know, personal details stop you talking to a parent and the team, because, you know, these are very skilled health professionals. Just because they know who you are and have your details and record doesn't mean you can't have an incredibly good, trusting, still conversation with them. And I would, you know, really recommend that anybody who is worried and has a team in their area and just wants to have, maybe start with just an exploratory conversation of, this is what things feel like for me, or this is what my baby's doing. Is that normal? I think, you know, I feel like I lack confidence, but I feel like my baby's always crying and something's not right, we're not bonding properly. You can just talk about that, and you can say, and the teams will respond very compassionately to that. And that may end up just being giving you a little bit of advice and a sort of triage phone call where they say, actually, I know you're doing great, but maybe you need help with breathing or sleeping, or whether go to your health to those sports. Or they might say, yes, that sounds exactly that sort of thing we can help you with. Some amnesis, and we'll kind of get you a package of care that meets the needs. So they seem to be very skilled at having that conversation, and I would definitely encourage people who are worried and maybe don't have access to that, they can have that trusting conversation with, or hang on the right reassurance to contact the parent team directly if they've got one in their area, talk about what their needs are and how they're best met.
Brilliant. Sally, thank you so much for today. It's been really helpful. Where can people find out more about the Infant Parent Foundation?
So our website, parentsforfoundation.org.uk, and on there you'll find a range of things. There's a directory of teams. There's a lot of resources for professionals who want to set up a parenting team. And there's also a range of our kind of policy and influencing reports that talk about more about what parenting teams are, what they do, why government should be funding this sort of provision. Head there. And all of the information about the First 1,000 Days movement is also on that website. So you can see what we're doing, you can see our infographics and our evidence briefs. And if you think, yeah, I work in this area, whether you lead a massive national charity doing stuff for parents and babies, or whether you're just running a you know, a toddler group in your steps, or you can still join us and tap into all of the expertise and information that we share.
That's great. Thanks so much, Sally. And thank you to all our listeners. You know, you can find me at GavinJ417 and Instagram. Until next time, take care.
Thanks, Gavin.